Devices Radio Network.
Drugs and Stuff with Dave Crossland. I'm Scott McNally. This program is brought to you by True Nutrition. Our code is ADVICES, and we also have the new code, ADVICES Oats, which will give you 25% off of the oatmeal blends that ADVICES carries. This show is being broadcast through audio at advicesradio.com and on the new YouTube page for video, Think Big Bodybuilding Media. Dave Crossland, what's going on, brother? How you doing, man?
Not much, mate. Same old. Had a busy week with military stuff. Haven't seen a gin for a while, so I had to really need to sort that out.
Oh, man.
But, yeah, it is what it is. But, no, okay, mate, not bad at all. It gets into silly season for me now, so it's just going to get busier and busier as the weeks go on.
Good.
You'll start seeing me doing these from strange hotel rooms and weird army bases and all sorts over the next few months.
That'll be fun. I'm at VJ's house right now, for anybody watching this. I'm in his office, his chair. This is where Bodybuilding Nerds is recorded from his end. He has a nice view. The windows are a little bright. I probably could have done something to control the light a little bit better. I think I'm a little blown out, but whatever. We'll live with it today. I just came straight from the gym and from the grocery store. Man, it's been a busy freaking week for me, just trying to get everything together. I just put up a Brandon Curry interview today. And then tomorrow we are putting up an interview with DLB. And then after that, we've got a show with Dylan Armbrust from Armbrust Pro Gym out in Mile High Mecca in Denver. So lots going on right now, man. It's been busy trying to build things up.
Isn't there a video circulating of Brandon pulling a machine on top of him or something?
Dude, I saw that, man. I think that just happened yesterday.
I haven't seen it. I've just heard about it. What happened?
I'm guessing the thing wasn't bolted down, but he was finishing his workout. And I believe it was like a tricep machine. He had his hands overhead. And as he was pulling, the whole thing came down on top of him. It pushed him forward. I believe he hit his head a little bit too. And he busted up his knuckle a little bit. But I feel like it could have been a lot worse, man. Because that whole machine pushed him into what looked to be like, the stand that they'll put like all the cable attachments on. Right in front of him. So basically his head went careening toward that. So that could have been a lot worse, man. It could have been terrible.
I've pushed a Smith machine over before now.
Have you really?
Yeah, shoulder pressing with too much weight on it. So it got very top heavy when I got to the top of the rep.
Were you seated?
Yeah.
So you were seated. You pushed this thing all the way up. You're a big guy, so you probably have long arms. You probably pushed that thing pretty far up, and then it dumped. That's weird, man. I've never thought of that happening before. That's scary.
Yeah, it was weird, but I think one of the problem was I took all the weight that was at the bottom of the machine on the stacks either side, and that was then on the bars, so there was literally no weight on the bottom of the machine.
Okay.
And so as I went up full height, it went backwards on me.
Okay. Wow.
That's fun.
I bet that was loud, too.
Didn't go all the way over.
Oh,
but
okay.
It lifted.
Okay.
Still enough to go, ooh, fuck.
Oh,
check
yeah.
your underpants for pound marks.
I'm thinking, I know there's been a machine that I've kind of taken off balance. I can't remember what it was. I know what it was. A belt squat. And they're getting rid of it. They're replacing it with like the pit shark, which is a different version of the belt squat. But this thing, I know that when I'd have it loaded up, just when I'd go to stand on it, the whole thing would kind of like tip on me a little bit. It can get dangerous, man, especially if you're belted in at the same time. You're going anywhere that thing's going if it starts falling, you know?
Yeah, I've trained in a few gyms over the years, especially in the early days where, you know, you were on a bench and you spent more time trying to hold the bench level than you did actually doing anything else, because all the hinges on the bench were so loose, the whole fucking thing would wobble on you when you moved.
Yeah. That used to be like every gym in the UK as of 15 years ago, from what I understand. Everybody I talked to, man, you guys had like all the like the dirtiest, most hardcore basement gyms back then.
There was, but there was still, I mean, there were still good gyms with good equipment.
Yeah.
The difference was with a lot of the gyms in those days, the equipment was homemade or locally sourced. So gym owners would go to an engineer with an idea and develop a machine off the back of that.
Yeah.
I don't, you know, we go back for 20 years and we didn't have the same level of machine supply that there is now and commercial machine manufacturers that there is now. So a lot of machines just got made by the gym owner or by an engineer that he knew or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And obviously with that, there was definitely some learning curves on some of the machines as they were first made out. But I mean, I spent the bulk of my career training at a gym, Maloney's gym in Huddersfield, and the equipment was all built by the owner, and I would put it against anything that's been built by any company. It was all brilliant kit.
That's cool. That's cool. I've been to some gyms like that. There's a place in northern Michigan that's owned. It's still there. It's called Joe's Gym up in the UP in a town called Marquette. Not a big city. And he was a former prison guard. And he has this this very small gym. I can't even tell you how many square feet, but it'd be about this, like, I'm going to guess, you know, no more than like a couple thousand square feet. And if that even, and he packed that thing in so tight with equipment. Plus he manufactured a lot of it. And then he even fabricated like additional pieces with welding that were on existing machines. Like he took a Smith machine and then he welded pins on the outside of the Smith machine so that you could also stand in front of it and use it as a rack if you wanted to put a bar on it instead.
Yeah, I mean, I know Paul made some just 90-degree seated benches.
Okay, yeah.
And he just tweaked the backs ever so slightly.
Yeah.
So they were about a 22-degree lean or a 20-degree lean. It was very, very slight.
Yeah.
But it made the world a difference.
It does, yeah.
You know, and it was like the bench seat heights were just at the right height so that you would just sat a little bit lower so you're in a more powerful position and lots of things like that over the years with kit that he's made.
I like that.
I mean, he made a lat pull down machine with a 500-pound stack.
Okay.
Which was nice.
500-pound stack. You don't see that often.
No. His calf machine, standing calf machine at a 1,050-pound stack.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah, that was a serious bit of kit.
And so could you use that? Could you use the whole thing ever on any of those heavy machines? Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
I stacked every machine he had.
Okay. No kidding.
His low row was a 200-kilo stack. Stacked that. Okay. Used to stack the calf machine.
Nice.
Dorian tried to buy the calf machine off him.
Did he really?
No kidding. Several times, and he wouldn't sell it to him.
Huh. No kidding. That's funny.
Yeah. Man. And the shoulder pads on it were literally 8-10 inches thick.
Okay. Wow.
Because of the amount of weight that was pushing down. When I first started using it, I used to wear two belts.
Why two belts? Because it was so intense?
Just because the stack was so heavy and I was using so weight, my core just couldn't cope with trying to lift 1,000 pounds up every time.
Yeah, I bet, man. I bet. Did your calves grow on that thing?
Oh, yeah. 24.5 inch.
No kidding. Wow.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
I think it's one of the mistakes that people make with calf use is they just don't go too heavy. They don't go heavy enough.
Okay. Yeah, it's something I've never had to work a lot because calves have always been strong for me. But that's the advice that I've given other people, and I've seen it work, that just get in, get warmed up, and then go straight to the heavy stuff and do as many reps as you can with heavy weight. That's what I've seen as being successful for people. Yeah? You do drop sets?
Heavy drop sets. So you'd start with a weight that you could only get 4 or 5 reps with, drop, get another 4 reps, drop, get another 4 reps, failing every time. So you build a setup of over 20 reps.
Okay.
But all very heavy, very intense. That will make your calves grow like no tomorrow.
I can see that. Well, listen, we have a bunch of questions here. Instead of going to any kind of topics or anything, my thought is that if we just get right to these things, I think we could probably fill up a whole show with the content we have. Guys, if you're not a member of the group, we have a new group for Advices Radio. Just called Advices Radio. It's in the groups. And, you know, it's a private, it's a closed group, as they call it. Once you ask to be a member, you know, I'm improving everybody, but just, you know, this way it's not just floating out there openly, or your questions, they aren't just floating openly, you know, throughout Facebook, that it has to be somebody that is already involved with Advices Radio that's going to see it. You know, your boss isn't that way going to be floating around Facebook and find these questions. That said, I created a thread for drugs and stuff. If I can scroll down to it here. Man, that last episode that we did with Sean, that was pretty intense, man. Sean Bellin.
Yeah, that's not out yet, is it?
Nope, it's not out yet. But by the time everybody sees this, it's going to be. So,
all right. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I keep forgetting that.
Yes.
It confuses me.
Yeah. All right. So
look, I'd be shit at filming a TV series if you did it out of sequence. I'd just be useless. Completely right. Lost.
All right. So this one we'll start with. This is from a guy called Chris. He says, question, what is the point of insulin post-workout? He says, once again, I apologize if my info is wrong. I am reliant on online info. And listen, this is what I think this show is really good about. Because, you know, I feel, Dave, like a lot of the programs that we do at Advices, we maybe skip some of the basic stuff. And, you know, we just take it for granted that everybody knows how to run a cycle, you know, and that everybody knows how to do, you know, basic things with gear. But not everybody knows. Oh, Dave lost his speakers there.
I need a longer cable. I really do. So what you're saying is that this show is dumb, then. That's effectively what you're saying, isn't it?
I was trying to say it in a very nice way, though.
It's we're thick on this show, and we don't do the highbrow stuff that you do on your other posh, high-taluting, fancy shows. Is that how it is, then, is it?
I was trying to put it in a very nice way. No. Who is it? What's the researcher's name out in Australia? You're friends with her.
Meh.
Yeah,
which is not pronounced like that. Mia, I'm sure it's pronounced Mia. I get this wrong all the time. Mrs. Underwood. That's the name.
There you go, Mrs. Underwood. She had said too. She said I've gotten. She said the one thing I've heard from people that listen to your show is that sometimes it's too complex and that they can't understand stuff. And my thought is, you know, we never want to just like spoon feed people, but at the same time, though, there is some basic education that I think some people are lacking. And I see stuff like this where somebody says, you know, all of my information comes from the internet. It's like, this is a great place then that we can kind of correct some of that stuff.
There is some argument that states that the natural insulin spike post-workout is more than adequate for nutritional partitioning that you need at that point, and that exogenous insulin post-workout is completely useless and pointless and not required.
Hmm. Well, here's his question. He says, to my knowledge, the purpose of a post-workout meal is to fuel your workout. That way you have readily available nutrients so your body doesn't have to rely on glycogen stores. You eat, blood glucose levels go up, insulin spikes, and the glucose gets sent to storage. So fats are usually recommended to be eaten with the carbs so that you have more saturated, sustained glucose levels throughout your workout. But then if you use exogenous insulin, you are sending the glucose to storage, which seems to defeat the purpose of a post-workout meal to begin with. Am I missing something or just wrong about how this works?
Right, hang on. Post-workout meal is providing your energy for your workout. It's post-workout.
Well, maybe he means pre. He just said P-W-O. So he must mean pre-workout.
Right, pre-workout meal. Firstly, our energy stores are not that finite in the sense that they're not that rapidly responsive.
Okay.
The energy that you use for the workout is energy that you have gained, stored, and consumed over the period of time from your last workout. We don't react on glucose levels that are just sat in the blood.
Okay.
There's just not enough energy there. So we will always use stored glycogen. We will always deplete glycogen levels within muscle during a workout. That's part of what we do.
Right.
Most people will probably use a pre-workout insulin injection just for what the theory is, and this is the one that Mylos pushes, is that you do a pre-workout insulin shot and you take a pre-workout shake, which contains citrulline and all sorts of weird and wonderful, and you have another intra-workout that's as complex as that. His theory is that from the very first point that you damage muscle tissue, you are starting to push nutrient into that muscle to speed up recovery.
Yeah.
Personally, I think it's a waste of fucking time.
Okay.
I don't think it makes one iota a difference whatsoever. But what it will do is give you a very responsive pump.
This I've seen, absolutely.
And it can be insanely big, you know, almost detrimentally big. So a lot of people like that. A lot of people attach to that, that that's a positive thing, that that means that they're doing better in their workout because they're sustaining greater pumps. And so a lot of people find that as a positive motion. If it's post-workout, generally speaking, the general consensus is that you eat your post-workout meal. Now, some people argue that you're already going to get a huge insulin spike that is going to shuttle nutrient into the muscle very, very quickly, because at this point, you're basically a nutritional sponge.
Yeah.
You're very sensitive post-workout, and your body is just looking for recovery. It's looking for nutrients, so it's going to take anything you give it. The theory behind the insulin is that you push it in so quick and so hard that you are able to consume almost a secondary post-workout meal very shortly afterwards.
Yeah, you'd eat more effectively.
Yeah,
and deliver
because you've used that previous meal up so readily, you've dispersed that so quickly, there's room in the line then to get another meal in. How effective that is in real terms, the post-workout insulin allowing you to get extra food in, yeah, that is definitely going to be beneficial as long as you're in a position where you can utilize those extra calories and extra nutrient, and that's not just going to be stored as excess.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But this fast-acting carbs before a workout bollocks has very little impact whatsoever, because you're going to use circulating glucogen up very, very quickly, and you're going to turn to glycogen stores pretty much within, you know, 15 minutes, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And the more you improve that system, then the more glycogen you can hold. Hmm. And as a result, the better your endurance will become.
I can see that, yeah. I have found with post-workout nutrition, I found better recovery, maybe. Or I'm sorry, intra-workout nutrition. I found better recovery. I will say that we really overdid it.
Do you find better recovery in the sense of less DOMS?
Yes. Yeah.
Or do you find better recovery in the sense that you just don't feel as depleted post-workout?
I'd say both. But definitely, yeah, the less soreness afterward. I've noticed that. And it was specifically when we were doing really long workouts. There was a point where I trained with Shelby Stearns for a few years straight, especially on back day. And when he was getting ready, he did Chicago Pro, I think 3-4 years in a row. And I mean, we'd hit it hard, man. Like 3-hour workouts at times, 2.5 on average.
Yes.
And
I find that counterproductive. I think that's way too long to sustain any level of intensity.
Believe it or not, like when I first started training with him, I couldn't. And over time it became like I got conditioned to be able to do that, where I couldn't, like when I first started training with him, like I literally felt like I would die by afterward. You know what I mean? Like the rest of the day, I was just shot. Like just driving home from the gym was difficult. Mm-hmm. But then give that 6 months, a year, and I was able to hang. And plus we were doing like these really controlled things. So before I'd be using, you know, 150 pound dumbbells for a row. And then by the time I'm training with him, I could only handle like an 80, because we were doing like these 3 full second negatives and then driving hard and then squeezing for like a full second and then 3 full second. All that stuff, man, the intensity was brutal. It really did teach me a lot. You know, at the time, John Meadows was writing the programs we were doing. But, you know, I've evolved since then. My workouts are only like an hour long, and I get a lot of intensity out of far fewer sets. It worked for me at the time, but we were using a lot of post-workout nutrition. This was like 2013 to 2016. It was real popular then. Like I worked.
You're gonna need to though. You're gonna need to at that level of expenditure because you just don't have the stores capable of providing for that.
Exactly. Exactly. So you know, if you're in there for an hour, you know, that's another story, right? But like at the time, man, we worked up to like 200 grams of carbs from like highly branched cyclic dextrins, you know, and 25, 50 grams of amino acids and protein. And by the time you were done, you're like, yeah, like you said, man, you needed that just to get through and just to maintain a pump. But for a guy who's doing a 1 hour workout, man, I think that you probably don't, you know, I think that it's probably, you know, a waste. And the insulin, I mean, I don't know. I think you and I kind of have a differing opinion on it. I think you make a really good point. I've never heard anybody say this before. For anybody who hasn't heard Dave say this on one of the previous episodes, Dave's thought is, because hey, we got to expect. We're on Think Big now on YouTube. This is a new channel. We might be picking up some new listeners. Dave, your belief is that you get too good of a pump in the gym, you may quit early, right? You might not be able to push to the same amount of exercise and you know, the same amount of intensity you would have otherwise.
Not so much as you quit early, but it will definitely, particularly in single lever movements, it will definitely restrict your range of motion.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, all right. I had big arms. They were particularly big.
Okay.
But if I used insulin pre-workout, my range was from there to there. And that was it. It would not go any further because the rest of it was pumped to full. And it's like, well, I'm doing quarter of a movement. I'm doing half a movement. You know, this isn't going to be productive to damaging muscle fiber and creating growth.
How many inches did you get your arms up to?
26 and a half.
It's a big arm. It's a lot of arm.
Hmm? I mean, they're not. I mean, bear in mind, I don't really train anymore.
Okay, we can see you. Just you're almost off. Your arm's almost off camera, but we can see it.
There you go.
That's a lot of arm right there.
So yeah, there's still 22, 23, and I don't think I've trained him in 2.5 months.
You haven't even been to the gym in like the last week, right? You're saying so. That's like zero.
I was on holiday for 2 weeks before that, so that's 3 weeks. I've been once in I think the last 3.5 weeks.
Oh man. We got to get you back in the gym.
Yeah, I know. I don't know. Just seem lacking motivation for it at the moment.
I'm glad you didn't crash the Winnebago, by the way.
Yes, no, we survived. It's back. Now plotting and planning a bit of a makeover.
Yeah. We'll have to get you on. There used to be a TV show on MTV where they'd like, called Pimp My Ride. That's what it was.
Yeah, I remember it.
We'll get you. We got to get your RV on that.
No. No. There were stories, I don't know if it was true, that half the rides that they actually did on that were absolute bags of shit.
Really? No kidding. No kidding.
That there were a lot of problems. It was Exhibit, wasn't it?
Mm.
Or it was Exhibit for quite a while.
Huh.
And it started off with West Coast Customs, didn't it? And then it moved to Gas. Gas started doing the customization.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know anything about that.
Big Pimp My Ride fan in my day.
All right. Next question is from Jeff Baker. He says, Dave has said that he doesn't like EQ. What does he think is a good substitute for EQ? Can I guess? May I?
Yes.
DECA?
Yeah.
I know you like DECA. I've heard that before. I remember you saying that.
It's not that I don't like EQ. I just, the RBC issues are very problematic.
Yeah.
And the one thing that we all don't pay enough attention to is our hearts. And that's the one thing that's at most risk from our usage, our hearts. And everyone goes, well, I get blood work done. Blood work doesn't really show the state of your heart. It will show you risk factors.
Yeah.
But it doesn't show you how those risk factors are impacting. So it will show a high RBC and hematocrit, you know, and thick blood. It will show a high LDL, low HDL, but it won't actually tell you if they're impacting your heart.
Okay.
In order to check your heart health, you have to specifically check your heart.
Yeah.
And EQ is androgenically quite mild. It's not a particularly harsh drug. You know, it's not something that's going to really tax your system. But that impact that it can have on RBC and that impact it can have on blood viscosity can be severely damaging in other areas if you're not on speed of what you're doing. So I just, for me, the risk reward ratio just isn't there with that drug.
Okay.
Now, I have seen in the past, and I actually didn't think this was too bad an idea, a front load of EQ and then pull it.
Okay. Okay.
Because you'll start with high RBC.
Yeah.
And then obviously it will start to dissipate as you get into your cycle, but you start with very high nutritional transit from the high RBC.
Okay, I can see that.
But yeah, I'm just not a big, big, massive fan of it. And it's not that I think there should be something that is like EQ, or I just think there's drugs that offer a better reward for the level of risk that they pose.
What do you think of DHB? Which is a relative, you know, obviously.
Yeah, it's harsh.
Yeah, yeah.
And I find a lot of people, it is a strong drug, and in that it is an effective drug, but I find quite good for strength as well. But I find that a lot of people start to struggle with it, with headaches and just generally feeling like shit. Yeah. It does seem to be very, very harsh on the system. I've not seen enough blood work to give a more comprehensive answer on that front, but the blood work I have seen, obviously we've seen RBC elevation and stuff like that, but I've seen quite a lot of liver stress as well.
Really?
And nice. Just general overall body stress from it. Mm. And a few people complain about it completely screwing their appetites.
Oh, wow. Well, I didn't have that happen. I used it twice. My appetite wasn't affected. I was lucky too, because I didn't get much pain from it. I've known a lot of people that have gotten a lot of pain.
It's a fucker for crashing.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, some of that's down to people just not knowing how to make it fucking properly.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people just think, well, you heat the solvent with the fluid in it, with the powder in it. You mix it up. You add your carrier oil. You add your benzyl alcohol, you filter it, and that's job done. Some compounds require better carrier oils.
Yeah, absolutely.
To improve the stability. And some compounds don't want to be heated too quickly. And some need to be a little bit gentler with. And DHB is one of those that, if you don't know what you're doing, it is notorious for crashing. And one of the problems with that, and one of the reasons why you get a lot of pain off it, is it will even start to crystalline after injection.
Oh, yeah.
So that's why it becomes painful, like, because it literally, so it literally crashes as it goes in, so to speak. So yeah, it can be a bitch for storage and crashing, and it can be a very painful injection.
I got a question for you, semi-related when we talk about brewing. Well, I will say too that I know that from what I had seen, DHB, they tried to do it like literally 20 years ago. And it never gained popularity because they didn't have good solvents. And then maybe 10 years ago, they did start coming. You know, there was like more of the like EO was available. And I've seen better products now. But then I've had like another guy I work with. He just said like, oh, I want to try it. And I trust this company that I get my stuff from. And then he ended up having a lot of pain just taking a half cc to test it. Like it crippled him. So
yeah,
it's obviously not all good. I got a gear-related manufacturing question for you.
Okay.
Why will some products tend to oxidize more? I may or may not know somebody who has a bunch of Sustanon that turned dark brown. The other products hadn't. So for some reason, and that hadn't happened to this company's Sustanon before, but it oxidized over a several-month period of time.
I honestly don't know. I don't know if it's something to do with the raws or something to do with the way it's cooked, but I honestly don't know. I'll ask a few questions of people that are a bit more on top with me when it comes to the finite points of cooking.
Hey, if anybody you know, actually, it'd be great. It'd be great, actually, if we could do an interview I mean, even if we got somebody to wear like a mask or something, I would love to do an interview with a chemist. That would be a badass show, wouldn't it?
I know an ex-chemist.
Okay, that's even better then. We don't have to worry about getting somebody in trouble.
Oh, he'd still want to be anonymous, but...
Yeah. We can do... Have you ever seen... There's a documentary called Drugs. It's on Netflix in the U.S. And they follow law enforcement. Like, they ride along with the cops. And they talk about, like, what's going on, what their motives are. And then they go... Then they also are with the criminals. So, like, they'll have, like, these guys that are, like, slinging crack, that are, like, up the chain, that are bringing the cocaine into L.A., and then giving that to, like, guys who run the drug houses, and then it's distributed, you know, in crack, made into crack. And, like, you see this all happening, and all these guys are wearing, like, masks so they can hide their identity. Yeah, we need to get one of those guys on, but, like, a steroid guy. He can wear his mask for the whole thing.
I'll have a word with a lot of know. I mean, he's been out of the game a couple of years, but he's pretty good when it comes to cooking knowledge, so I'll have a chat with him.
Dude, that would be... So fucking fun. I did an interview with a guy I know, and we never aired it because I was just afraid. I didn't want to get him in trouble, you know. Like, I didn't want to put that on him, and he was okay with putting it out. And I was like, no, let's just scrap it. And I ended up deleting the file. But we had a great interview. There's some awesome questions. I think it could be really educational to a lot of people out there that are using gear.
I agree. It's interesting you said that DHB was pushed some years ago and never really gained popularity.
Yeah.
I'm not so sure if that was more down to a case of changing attitudes in drug usage rather than anything else. Because,
really?
Well, you go back 15 years and we didn't look out the strongest compound we could get our hands on.
Okay, yeah.
You know, the drive with drug use wasn't that. Now... For a large number of drug users, they're interested in what's the strongest.
Yeah.
And you see it all the time in the forums, on the Facebook pages. You know, what's the best drug out there for this? What's the best drug out there for that? As we all well know, that's probably the wrong end of approaching this. You know, what's the best training would be your best question, I would have suspected.
Yeah, yeah.
And get that right, and you'll pretty much grow on anything.
That'll segue to our next question here. This is from Joseph. He says, how guys like Rolly, Bonick, Curry, etc. stay that big and lean year round? They never come off, just blast and change compounds.
That's, right.
You know?
There's the first thing. How do you know they stay that big all year round?
Yeah, because he's probably not in the gym with them. He just sees the pictures. But then you take all your pictures when you're at your best, right?
Yeah, and then you use them all year round.
Yeah.
Think about it. Was it the last Olympia? A lot of pictures circulated about a month afterwards about Rami looking a lot smaller.
That's right. We did see those, didn't we? Yeah.
Because a lot of guys do drop size post-Olympia or post-pro tour.
Yeah.
But they just make sure they're not seen.
Yeah.
If you're normally a 280-pound in decent condition bodybuilder and you drop back down to 250, you're staying covered up.
Yeah.
It's bad for business.
Right.
So you stay covered up. And then you don't start posting up pictures of you looking big and freaky again until you are big and freaky again.
And then you just act like, yeah, bro, I've always been like this.
Yeah, because that's business.
Yeah.
So it's difficult to say... Are these guys this size, this condition all year round? I don't know.
Yeah.
Some will be. Some won't. And I think most at some point will take the foot off the gas and just back off and give everything a break a little time because they know they can't go at it hammer and tongs day in, day out.
Yeah.
What is happening within the Camel Crew guys, and I mean Rolly at the moment is just carrying insane size.
He really is, yeah.
But then when you look at their approach, it is so every aspect, every element of what they do is managed.
Yeah.
You know, they're sitting in wherever they're staying and their meals are delivered to them and they go to the gym to train and they've got 2-3 training partners all there for specific reasons and plate loaders and every aspect of what they do is catered for.
I just did that interview with Brandon Curry that just came out right now and at the time of this recording, basically. And yeah, I said, what do you do? What does your day look like? And he said, well, I wake up and I eat. And then usually I go back to sleep for a couple hours, and then I wake up and I eat, you know, and then I go to the gym. You know, he just like, that's all he does is just bodybuild, you know.
Yeah.
His day off, he might sit around, or his coach takes him out for a couple hours, you know, that's it.
But even Brandon's going to have endorsement obligations and sponsorship obligations, and they still have to work to some degree.
Sure, sure.
And I mean, I know a few pros that have been like, you know, I'm tired, I'm fed up, I'm dieting, but I've got to go stand on this stand for 5 hours. I don't want to meet anyone. I don't want to fucking talk to anyone.
Right.
I'm 6 weeks out from a show, but it's their job.
Yeah.
Where the Camel Crew guys are sponsored by the Camel Crew, so they don't have any endorsement obligations.
Yeah.
They don't have to handle the business side of things. But, you know, I don't think there's any real super secrets.
I agree. I don't think there is.
I think it's just a case of every little aspect done perfectly.
Yeah. And I'm sure that the gear is going to be, I have heard this, the gear is going to be good. You're not going to have to be, you know, you're not in the States where you don't know quite what you're getting. What you get is good 1 month and then it's not the next, you know. It's going to be consistent.
The gear will be top notch. The blood availability will be on a regular basis. Any testing is required is going to be done there, done, dusted. There may be some playing with myostatin inhibitors. There are protocols that do exist and do work. They're not refined enough to be commercialized, but there's no doubt that there is, and athletes have used myostatin inhibitors.
Yeah.
So there is that aspect. Maybe they are dabbling a little bit in that on a lower end level. Yeah. But I think the big thing is it's just perfection in the way they approach everything.
And then also too, you know, off season, let's say you take a guy like Dexter Jackson and he's at Gold's Gym every day training in his tank top year round. He never looks bad, but Dexter Jackson is like 50 years old now. He's been doing this his entire life. That muscle's not going anywhere. He's going to always be consistently eating a clean diet because he knows he has to make appearances. He wants to look good too. Dexter never gets overly fat. You know what I mean? Part of that is going to be genetics, but part of that is the fact that, like, you take a guy like Dave Kalik, who, you know, got to be huge. He doesn't try anymore. He's not even really lifting that much, but he's got a ton of muscle that just sits there. It's not going anywhere. He calls it his leftover muscle, but he's like bigger than most guys, you know?
No, I agree. You know, you get this all the time. You know, what do the pros do? Yes, there are pros that stay on all year round. Of course there are.
Yeah.
But I know pros that come off. I know pros that use very low doses.
We see it in some of them too. Look at Sean Roden. You know, he's always shrunk down and looked very unimpressive in the offseason.
Luke, I know what Luke's been using. And I know guys that are sub 190 using more.
Yeah.
You know, Sean Tavernier doesn't do much in the pro circuit anymore, but he won Rookie of the Year quite a few years ago now. And Sean's drug uses was incredibly mild, ridiculously so. He grew despite what he was doing more than because of what he was doing. And Sean off-season generally takes it really easy. He tends to grow into shows because it's the only time he eats consistently and keeps on top of his diet.
There you go. Yeah.
He doesn't eat enough off-season. He's very casual with his food off-season.
Yeah.
So he builds into shows and he carries an insane amount of muscle. But when you look at these guys that carry an insane amount of muscle for their frames, there is one thing that is continuous throughout them all.
What's that?
They train fucking hard.
Mm.
And that's the one thing that I've noticed in all of them. They train hard.
Let me ask you, Dave. So your arm, you said you still have 22-inch arms. I know you're
something
not
like that.
I don't know I know you're not training right now, but how many grams of test do you use just to keep that?
I use 250 milligrams of Sustanol once a fortnight.
A fortnight means every day, right?
No, that means every 2 weeks. It's controlled by a doctor. It is prescribed.
Oh.
And I can't use any more.
because they won't sell me anymore.
There you go. There you go.
Yeah.
All right.
I may even have an empty box sat in here because I'm a scruffy git and don't throw things away properly. Oh, maybe I don't know. I said, well, there you go.
Aspen, 250 sus.
Yeah? Yeah. How many boxes of those did you say you take a week? I forget. All right, next question. Okay, we didn't answer this before, so he's going to copy and paste this here, so we better get to this one. This is from Andrew. He says, Dave says he doesn't like metformin used due to glucose and the liver. Can he explain on what he means?
Yeah, basically metformin affects the way our livers produce glucose. So metformin is a dual action in the body. The first thing it does is increase insulin sensitivity. The second thing is reduce the liver's conversion into glucose. So you are actually reducing the availability. Whereas berberine increases insulin sensitivity but doesn't affect the way the liver deals with glucose.
What's that in your hand, Dave? All right, for the listeners at home, Dave's not.
Well, I've got Dave. All sorts. There's a piss sample bottle there, and my desk is just littered with drug stuff.
For the listeners at home, Dave is not holding a syringe. For the people who aren't watching the video. Hey guys, why are you using sports nutrition that was designed for someone else? At TrueNutrition.com, they offer the world's largest selection of quality protein powders, and they let you design your own custom blend from a variety of powders, flavors, boosts, and packaging options, like the Team Skip blend, for instance. That's over 20 billion possible combinations to create a protein powder tailored to your diet, your goals, your tastes, and your budget. TrueNutrition.com also offers the ability to create delicious custom oatmeal blends. And they're third-party tested, proving that all their supplements are ensured to have the highest level of quality and value. Don't be a sucker and pay for fancy packaging and gimmicks. Discover the source that bodybuilders trust and stop using mass-produced nutrition that wasn't designed for you. TrueNutrition.com. And use our code ADVICES at checkout to let them know that you support the shows. With TRT being easier now to get private, that NHS, how does that affect life insurance? Do you have to declare that you would if it was, hold on a second, I'm having a... do you have to declare as you would if you were, if it was on your medical file, I guess he's saying, basically, if you're getting it private?
My understanding, and I'm not 100% on this, and hopefully there's someone listening that's got a bit more knowledge about insurance policies and such like, okay, that if you go for the NHS for TRT treatment, then it will be stated on your medical record. And part of your agreement with your insurance company is that they can access your medical records.
Okay.
If you go private, then it won't go on your NHS medical record. And therefore, as a result, the private insurance company can't access it. Legally, you are supposed to tell them.
Okay.
If you don't, you do run the risk of your medical insurance becoming null and void if they do find out that you've hidden such a thing from them.
That's scary.
So that's the risk you run. In the same way as if you insured your car and you said, oh, it's a 2-litre Ford Escort, and actually it's got a 3.5-litre Rover V8 slapped in it.
Okay.
If you crash the fucking thing and they find out it's got that big engine sat in it, they're not going to pay out because you lied about the risk element.
Okay.
And that's technically what you're doing with your life insurance. You're lying about the risk elephant because you're not declaring that you're on long-term medication.
Okay.
How much difference that makes in the terms of medical claims and medical costs, I haven't got a clue. I have no idea. So if anyone is or does have private medical insurance, and they have subsequently gone on TRT, if they have noticed an increase in their premiums, I'd be interested to hear. So please let us know.
Yeah.
I don't know how much it affects such things, if anything at all. I'm really not sure.
All right. Another question here. He says, I'll be interested to hear what you think about this, since you're not a fan of metformin. He says, because I don't know how this compares relatively. I've been hearing good things about berberine. When I look up what it does, it's a little advanced for my understanding. Could you explain in layman's terms to tell me how we would apply it for bodybuilding?
Well, effectively, metformin acts by increasing your insulin sensitivity. As a result, you respond much better to lower levels of insulin produced by your body.
Right.
That in turn means that you have greater nutritional partitioning. So you move nutrient throughout your body quicker, you absorb it more effectively, and you're less prone to gaining fat. The result is you're fuller. You have better response in glycogen stores, and in a calorie excess, you're much less likely to put calories as fat and more likely to use them in workout and recovery. And so all in general, you're going to grow and stay leaner as you do it.
He's asking about berberine, though. I was saying because metformin has a kind of a similar action.
Metformin has a similar action. The difference is metformin disrupts your energy distribution system.
I didn't know that. Okay.
Because it affects how your liver converts glucose.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not a big fan. From what I've seen a lot. I feel like I can get the same effects as a coach with berberine as I can with metformin without getting side effects from it.
Yeah. Yeah, so you don't have this issue where you're disrupting your glucose transport system. Because metformin works in two ways. Bear in mind that metformin's role is to keep your blood glucose levels low.
Yeah.
So it does that by improving insulin sensitivity, and it also does that by reducing the amount of glucose you can put into your blood system. Which is not good for people that are in an explosive performance-based activity, i.e. lifting weights.
Yeah.
Whereas berberine doesn't affect that glucose dispersal, transportation, conversion that the liver does, and it only works on the sensitivity side of things. So it makes us much more responsive. And so with that, you get all those benefits when you're trying to push the calories up and grow.
That makes sense. All right. Let's see what else we have here. We'll go to one more question here. This is from a guy named Scott, different Scott than me. He says, if you get a tab, this is interesting. I remember reading this. If you get a tablet, which is 100 milligrams per tablet, is the active compound evenly mixed throughout the tablet? So when you cut it in half, you would get 50 milligrams per pill, or is the 100 milligrams active ingredient in a small section of the tablet, say 20% of it, and over 80% is just filler to make up the tablet size. Therefore, if you were to, you could possibly take like 100 milligrams in a half a tablet.
Generally, that will be down to how well the mixed it.
Sorry, you broke up a little bit.
And it's that simple. That will be down to how well the manufacturer has mixed it.
Okay.
And it is that simple.
Yeah.
If you get two different colored paint powders, you put them in a bowl, you stir them five times, and then you push them through a pill press, what you're going to get is marbled effect tablets.
Mm.
If you stir it continuously for 10, 15 minutes and push them through a pill press, what you're going to get is a blend of those colors and create another cover tablet.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's exactly the same with these ingredients. If they are blended correctly, then to a large extent, the dosage will be evenly spread throughout the tablet.
So that said, UGL, that's where you could run into issues, right?
Yeah. How much it's going to affect individual tablets is, I can't see I think the most likely situation would be that you'd end up with a clump of either active ingredient, as in raw powder,
yeah,
or you'd end up with a clump of filler. So you'd generally get tablets that were all filler or all compound.
Yeah.
I don't think you're going to get tablets that are an average of 10% this or, you know, but it is possible to get guar. And when you look at tablet testing,
yeah,
you'll tend to see that they will vary by... I've seen 10 milligrams vary by as much as 2 to 3 milligrams per tablet across the board.
Oh, yeah. I forget what the variation that they're allowed, but there's some decent variation that they're allowed to have in an active medication where, you know, if they say that it's 100 milligrams, it can be 90 or it can be 110. I can't remember the percentage, but there's some variance.
Well, I was looking at some test results from a UGL on 10 milligram Anavar tablets.
Okay.
And they ranged from 7.8 up to 13.2.
Okay, yeah. And that's probably not crazy.
There is a variation. And okay, you'd have to probably get 10 tablets with the 13.2 in order to actually have any significant impact on your dosing.
Right, right.
But there are significance, yes. I've not seen a broad spectrum testing on higher strength tablets, so I couldn't tell you what the range is there. I've seen plenty of tablets test low.
Yeah.
So it is, and even high. So I would suspect that it's as possible with a 50 mg tablet that the range could be upwards of 10 milligrams.
I could imagine that too, yeah.
But a lot of it is down to how well the UGL mixes.
Hmm.
There was a lab, D4Net, that got bust, and they got very highly criticized because they were using a cement mixer to mix their powdered raws.
You're kidding.
It was a brand new cement mixer, so in all intents and purposes, it's clean.
Yeah, yeah. That's a lot of gear, too, that you're mixing up if you're using a cement mixer.
Well, this was oral tablets, so...
Okay.
But the fact is that was actually a very good bit of kit because they'd turn it on and just leave it running. And it would just really, really would really well blend that powder. You leave that running for half an hour, 40 minutes, and that powder is going to be incredibly well blended.
I would think so.
And obviously, if it's bought brand new and it's sterilized from the first time it's used, there's no actual reason, even though it sounds very basic and rough-ass, actually, it's not such... The only big issue would have been cross-contamination to a small extent with the powders, but you're not going to talk major amounts, especially at that sort of level of volume.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, so, you know, it's still down to how well it's blended as to how consistent it's going to be throughout the tablets. But variations are definitely possible, yes. I don't think you'd get it to the point where if you split a tablet in half, you'd get all compound on one side and all filler on the other side.
Hmm.
It won't be that uniform. But you will see variations in tablet strength from tablet to tablet.
I'm downloading a PDF here that will show us. It might be too long to read right now. Yeah, I think it is. Different strengths, concentrates. Yeah, it'll be too much for me to find out right now. But I do know that I was talking to my doctor about medications, because I was taking a medication and it worked fine, and then I switched. I got a different generic. I was using a generic, and then my pharmacy switched to a different generic, and then it didn't work anymore. And we looked it up, mm-hmm, because she had thought that it was as high as 10% variance was okay, but it turned out that was a myth. So with the FDA, it is less than 10% of variance. So if it is marked at 100 milligrams, you're not going to get a 90 milligram tab in the U.S. if it's approved by the FDA. But you could get, you know, you could get a 5% variance, I bet. I bet it'd be more close to that. But like you said, Dave, it's something that you're not going to see, you know, if you're getting a 7 milligram tablet one day and a 13 the next, you know, of Anavar, it's not going to be much of a difference in your end result.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
Not at all. People, you know what? The people that are obsessing about that would probably do much better to obsess to the same level about the intensity in which they train or the strictness they are with their diet and nutrition.
This is true.
Because that will yield much greater results than fretting over whether an Anavar tablet is 22 milligrams stronger in that one than the other one.
Yes, this is true.
And you tend to find that people that obsess over drug culture and drug dosing and those sort of things generally would do well to look at other aspects of the lifting, and they'll get much greater improvement in that area.
Man, I'll tell you, man, I couldn't agree more, because there was a time that I was so focused myself even on, you know, if you're going to put a cycle together, this perfect cycle where, you know, all these, you know, this starts working at week one and this starts working at week four. And, you know, that you invest all this time and effort. Guess what I discovered 15 years later, Dave? It doesn't fucking matter. That by the end, man, you're going to get the same results if you just keep it simple and you're going to save money.
I used to do that with training.
Did you really? How so?
I used to sit and write programs.
Okay.
And then go through it and change it and change that. And like, well, if I do that, that's going to pre-exhaust this muscle, or that's going to do this. And now I want to follow it with that, because that's going to make that muscle work even harder now. Yeah. Because that muscle's pre-fatigued, so it's going to drag that one in. And I used to spend literally hours rewriting programs.
Oh, man. Yeah, I could see that. You know, at the same time, though, if you really enjoy thinking about it, it's kind of fun to obsess over that kind of stuff, you know?
And I'd go, and then I'd try, and then I'd play with the exercise and see how I could intensify it or how I could change the feel of it. And months, years, literally years of pissing about with stuff like this until I found what I felt was... not just that works for me, but I found that it works for most people as well. Yeah. Almost my own training system.
Oh, really?
I've never bothered really pushing it that way. But yeah, I mean, I did develop my own sort of training system and my own sort of exercise technique within that.
Really?
It's all very staged, so I don't believe that any training should be static.
Yeah.
I mean, the training needs to evolve and go through periods. And I believe in a period of engagement where you focus more on mind-muscle link, on getting the muscles to engage, on feeling the exercise, on making sure that the muscle's working correctly within that movement, and the load in that exercise is going to the target muscle.
I can see that. Sure. Absolutely.
Once that programming is done, then I look to push heavy weight.
Mm.
Then I look to increase intensity.
Yeah.
And then it becomes very instinctive where I'm not getting engagement right on that muscle group. So that muscle group will go back to the programming stuff where we're working on engagement. This one's flying, so we're staying with this as it is. We're not changing anything, you know. And so everything then became very, what's the word? Instinctive.
Yeah.
I develop a similar sort of program for when I coach, and that's why I like to see my clients, because I like to show them how I want the exercise performed. So they start off with a lot of engagement work, then they start off increasing the frequency at which they train a muscle, and then the volume's pulled right back, forcing them to increase the intensity.
Okay.
Huh. Because previous to that, what they've been doing is they've been doing movements that create a lot of feedback, a lot of pain, a lot of feel.
Yeah.
And then I strip it right back and give them very little sets.
Mm, so you got to get a lot more out of it now.
And the thing is, you're addicted now to feeling that pain.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you associate that pain with success.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, you don't have 25 sets to work your delts. Yeah. You've only got 14.
Yeah.
Shit. So now I've got to be super, super precious with how I train and how efficient I am with my movements, because I've got to be super intense. Otherwise, I'm not going to feel that pain.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to feel like the workout failed.
I can see that, man. Yeah.
And the rules are you can't repeat. So if you don't make it hurt in that session, tough shit, you've got to leave it till next time.
Huh. You can't keep doing five more sets.
No. You cannot. You've got it and that's it. Once you've spent your money, you can't spend no more. You know, that's your time limit. And then we start looking at adding in intensities to techniques and drop sets and supersets and stuff like that if we want to.
I like that.
It's like I've got a client at the moment who's going for a periodization of really intense high volume work.
Okay.
A lot of drop sets, a lot of giant sets, a lot of supersets. He'll do that for 4 weeks and then we'll stop. We'll drop him down to very low volume, very heavy compounds.
Hmm.
And he'll do that for 4 weeks and then we'll put him on some high volume stuff.
Okay.
Even if we go into GVT.
Hmm.
But a lot with training as well. He particularly is someone that likes variance in his training. He likes to change it regularly to keep himself interested.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I used the same bicep workout for the best part of 20 years.
Okay.
Never really changed.
Yeah, and obviously you didn't need to.
No, just it got more intense, but it never really changed.
Yeah.
There'd be the odd workout here where I'd do something a bit different and piss about with something else. In general, it never really changed. Yeah. Went back to the staples all the time.
Yeah,
and I found that with a lot of exercises that I've done, because I taught myself to make them work.
Yeah, you can. I agree, man. That you can change your entire split without changing the split at all. You know, just by changing your intensity, as you're talking about.
Rep speed, tempo, rest periods.
Yeah,
All sorts of things you can do. Yeah. To people say, oh, well, I've done the same workout for 5 weeks now, I'm bored. Well, there's all sorts of things you can do to change a workout. Even just rotating your exercise order.
Yeah.
So say you do chest, it's compound, isolation, compound, or it's compound, compound, isolation. Just start isolation. Yeah. Then go compound.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, simple little things like that. Completely transform a workout. Do 3-4 weeks of benching last, and then come back to benching first and watch your strength go through the roof.
Sure. Absolutely. I've done the same thing, man. There's no question.
And the thing is, if you're, say, you're a 225 bench, as in pounds, a 225 bencher, I'll speak American now.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
So say you're a 225 bencher.
Although I'm in Canada right now, so.
Oh, fuck knows what they do. French.
It's weird because the streets are in kilometers, but the weights are in pounds. So,
so say you're a 225 bencher and you're struggling to improve. So you move, you start flying first and you bench second. Because you've always benched 225, mentally, you're going to feel you can achieve 225.
Yeah.
So you will achieve 225 as a second exercise much, much quicker. Because you've been there before. It's familiar ground. You know the weight. You're comfortable with the weight. There's no fear element to any of that. You know you can do it.
Yeah, yeah.
But you've pre-exhausted.
Now it's going to be a different game.
So now when you go back to benching first again, you can go straight into 245.
Yeah.
Because you know the strength's there.
Yeah.
Because if you can achieve 225 as a second exercise, you can definitely achieve more than that as a first exercise.
No question.
But it's just having the confidence to do it.
And we talked to Scott Stevenson before about pre-fatiguing too, and there's definitely benefits to that as far as muscle growth goes. You know, that overall you can fatigue a muscle further if you pre-exhaust it first. So there were some studies to say that you weren't getting as much activation, say, out of a pec if you pre-exhausted, if you did then while you're doing your bench press second. But the fact was, though, you had already fatigued it so much that you're getting that, you're now still fatiguing it further. So,
and the thing is, when you go secondary compound movement, what happens is the supporting muscles come in to allow the primary muscle to work to a further point of depletion.
Right, exactly.
Because it's got support, where in an isolation movement, you can't do that because basically when the pec fails, the pec fails.
Yeah.
In a bench press, the pec will fail. And the delt and tricep will continue to allow the motion, the movement to continue,
right,
which will mean that that pec's still working at a less degree, pushing it beyond its normal failure point.
Yeah. I think that's huge. I think if there's anything, I mean, all this other stuff is valuable that we've talked about, but realistically, you know, Dave, like you said, it all comes back to the nutrition. It all comes back to the training. I feel like listening to this thought about training and pre-exhausting, it can be what's really life-changing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. The amount of people that just think they train hard and don't train hard. And there's so many different ways of training hard. I mean, I've always felt I trained rather intensely because I was basically taught by one of Dorian's training partners. So I grew up with, you know, you train till you puke and then your workout starts sort of thing.
Right. Yeah.
That sort of attitude. And then I trained with Alvin Small for a while. And like you were saying earlier about volume, Jesus Christ, he'd do 40 sets in total on a body part. And then it's like, right, now we're going to heavy bench.
Oh,
you know, I can't even pick the fucking bar up.
Yeah.
I've just done 5 chest exercises and now you're wanting me to heavy bench.
Yeah, he just warmed up.
His volume was insane. But not only that, his strength at volume was insane.
Yeah. That takes learning, you know. Really does.
He just phenomenally strong, having already done 4 or 5 different exercises, 5, 6, maybe even 7 sets per exercise. And then he's starting bench pressing, and he's starting with 4 plates aside.
And he's going heavier.
Yeah. Like, how the fuck do you have that level of muscle endurance?
Yeah.
You know, and that's another style of training hard.
Yeah.
Complete opposite end to the Dorian style of giving everything you've got into that one working set.
Sure.
But I've always enjoyed the shorter, more intense style workouts rather than the voluminous. I get bored if I'm doing a lot. Yeah.
It's funny because I've heard a lot of people say that people who do like short workouts, they say they get bored, or they get bored of like high rep sets, you know, for legs, especially. Yeah, I like really high reps on legs, and that's where I excel. But some people, they get to 10, 15 and they're like, oh shit, I'm tired now. I'm bored. This is lame. You know, they want to quit.
A lot of my quad workouts were still 6 to 8 reps.
Were they really? Wow.
And I've done the high volume. I've done the Widowmakers. I've done the sets of 20 reps on squats.
Yeah.
And I got to decent weight with it, but I'd get to about 10, 12 reps, and then I'd be just thinking, I want to get out of this.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I didn't want to attack the weight anymore. When I was getting under a weight that I was using for 6 to 8 reps, I was attacking every single rep.
You can say focus that whole time.
And that was the problem for me, is that the focus would wane at the end of the set, where really it was when I was really needing to dig in and really focus.
Mm.
And whereas in the shorter rep sets, I was aggressive.
Yeah.
And quite literally attacking the set. In the high volume sets at the end of it, I was just wanting to get out. I didn't have that aggression. It was just more of a mental fatigue at that point. So I was just trying to get through. So I didn't deliver my best performance.
I could see that, man. Yeah. I've seen that with people that like the shorter sets when I've trained with them. You know, they do. They get bored of that versus I'm more of a, with legs at least, I really like, I think of Tom Platz, and I know that like, I've seen him train people where you do 15 reps and then he says, okay, now your set started. This is where you're going to start growing. Like, this is where you really need to begin working, you know, that point where now you're ready to stop because it hurts so bad. You're getting bored. And he's like, okay, this is where we start, you know, let's do 10 more.
I used to do leg extensions where it was 15 sets, 5 seconds rest, 12 sets, 12 reps, sorry, 5 second rest. 10 reps, and that was one set.
That's brutal, man.
And that I could cope with.
Yeah.
But the high volume stuff on leg press, and it wasn't even the pain aspect of it, to be honest, because I actually enjoyed that side of things. Enjoyed that. It was just fucking on board.
Yeah.
I mean, I did for a period of time start pushing squats up to sets of 20. Never quite got 5 plates for 20, but I got close.
That's a lot of weight, man.
Yeah, it was
20 reps. Yeah.
Yeah, I was getting up there. 4, 4.5 was 20 reps. I used to probably stop about 18 on 5.
Wow.
But then I've never been a huge, huge squatter. I mean, my best squat's 300 for 6.
Okay.
Which is okay, but it's not
300 huge, kilos. Huge.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's a lot of weight, man.
Yeah, but it's not huge when you're fucking 360 pounds, is it? You know what I mean? When you look at it that way, it's a bit shit.
All right, man. But, listen, let's get out of here, Dave. I know you've got a bunch of work to do still. I've got a bunch of stuff to get going on here, too. But as always, man, always appreciate your time. Hey, if people want to reach out to you for some coaching, I know that you always have your website, which is right behind you, crosslands.org.uk. Where else can they reach out to you?
Best way is probably Facebook.
Okay.
So just Dave Crossland on Facebook. Just send me a message.
Are you taking new clients right now, by the way?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I am at the moment, yes.
Okay, cool. Well, guys, definitely reach out to Dave. And, of course, if you are watching this live, I know we have a few live listeners and viewers right now. Do me a favor. Head over to Think Big Bodybuilding Media on YouTube and subscribe. You know, I'm really grateful for the people that we have subscribed, but, you know, we want to try to get as many people as we can because, you know, we've got, we're going to keep putting more and more content out over there. Of course, you can listen to the audio shows over at advicesradio.com, and you can search Advices Radio on your favorite podcast apps. TrueNutrition.com, our sponsor. You can use our code Advices and Advices Oats. Like I said, reach out to Dave. Dave, it's always a pleasure, my friend.
Yeah, you too, my friend. You take care.
Dave wasn't even listening to me. All right, I'll see you guys.
I was, but you say the same sponsorship shit every fucking week. I've heard it a million times.
Advices Radio Network.